system. The meditation centre proved seriously hard to find, which wasn't surprising. Isolation was the point. When we finally arrived, I was shown to my room, a narrow, monkish cell, looking out over miles of uninterrupted forest. It contained a single bed, a sink, a small wardrobe, a shelf, and nothing else. I stowed my suitcase under my bed and hurried to the main hall, where a staff member outlined the week's ground rules. We would be expected to spend 1 hour a day helping to clean the building, or prepare food, or do the dishes, she explained. In a few moments' time, she would ring the small brass gong on the building's central staircase, and we would be expected to fall silent, with only a handful of exceptions, including emergencies and question-and-answer sessions with the teachers, for the rest of the retreat. Since we wouldn't be speaking, she added, it would be best if we kept our eyes downcast too, so as to avoid the temptation to spend the week communicating via smiling, scowling, and winking. There would be no alcohol, no sex, no use of telephones or the internet, no listening to music, and also no reading or writing, since these, she said, could rupture one's interior quiet as surely as audible conversation. Then again, as the daily schedule we found pinned to the notice board made clear, there would be no time for any of that, anyway. 5:30 a.m. waking bell. 6 a.m. sitting meditation. 6:30 a.m. breakfast. 7:15 a.m. work period, kitchen cleaning, food preparation, etc. 8:15 a.m. sitting meditation. 9:15 a.m. walking meditation. 10 a.m. sitting meditation. 10:45 a.m. walking meditation. 11:30 a.m. sitting meditation. 12 noon, lunch, followed by rest. 1:45 p.m. walking meditation. 2:15 p.m. sitting meditation. 3 p.m. walking meditation. 3:45 p.m. sitting meditation. 4:30 p.m. walking meditation. 5 p.m. light meal. 6:15 p.m. sitting meditation. 7 p.m. walking meditation. 7:30 p.m. Dharma talk. 8:30 p.m. walking meditation. 9 p.m. sitting meditation. 9:30 p.m. sleep, or further meditation. Well, that'll be the structure you were looking for, I said to Adina, who was standing nearby. The moment I'd said this, it struck me as an annoying, smart aleck kind of remark. What made it worse, somehow, was that it was the last thing I said. A few seconds later, we heard the deep ring of the gong, and silence descended. It didn't take very long on the meditation cushion, however, to discover that outer silence did not automatically confer inner silence. For the first several hours after receiving the basic instructions, the rest of the first evening and most of the following morning, my mind was occupied almost exclusively by song lyrics, looping loudly on repeat. Inexplicably and appallingly, they were mostly the lyrics to the 1997 song Barbie Girl by the Danish-Norwegian kitsch pop group Aqua, a track I had always despised. The music was interrupted only by occasional anxious thoughts about how I was going to make it through the week, plus stray entries from my to-do list that I'd forgotten to deal with prior to my departure. In my defence, this, the mental chatter in general, not Barbie Girl, is almost everybody's first experience of silent meditation. When you eliminate the distractions of external noise and turn your attention inwards, what strikes you first is this. It's almost constantly noisy in there. It's not that the inner chatter is somehow generated by the attempt to meditate. It's simply that outer noise, the rest of the time, drowns out the inner noise. In the silence of the forest and the meditation hall, it all became suddenly audible. One realizes, as the spiritual teacher Jiddu Krishnamurti once put it, that one's brain is constantly chattering, constantly planning, designing, what it will do, what it has done, the past impinging itself on the present. It is everlasting chattering, chattering, chattering. An understandable response to such chatter, when you're attempting to meditate, is to try to quieten it, to dampen it down, or perhaps even to try to stop thinking altogether. But one central principle of Vipassana meditation, the variety taught at the Insight Meditation Society, is the opposite, to let the clamour be. As the Buddhist teacher Steve Hagen says in his pithy guidebook Meditation Now or Never, we do not try to forcefully detach ourselves from the feelings, thoughts, and expectations that arise in our mind. We don't try to force anything into or out of the mind. Rather, we let things rise and fall, come and go, and simply be. There will be times in meditation when we're relaxed, and times when our minds are agitated. We do not seek to attain a relaxed state or to drive out our agitated and distracted mind. That is just more agitation. This is the first big step towards non-attachment, learning to view passing thoughts and feelings as if one were a spectator, not a participant. Consider it too closely, and this idea becomes dizzying, given that watching your own thought processes is itself a thought process. It can be easy to feel caught in some kind of infinite loop. Fortunately, it isn't necessary to resolve this conundrum in order to practice meditation. The technique, as Howard had explained, is simply to return, every time you realize you've been carried away by a narrative or by an emotion, to the breath. The following evening, during the teacher's daily talk, he quoted the Catholic mystic St. Francis de Sales, a practitioner of Christian meditation. "Bring yourself back to the point quite gently. And even if you do nothing during the whole of your hour but bring your heart back 1,000 times, though it went away every time you brought it back, your hour would be very well employed." There is more to non-attachment than this, and much more, it's worth emphasizing, to Buddhism than non-attachment. But it is where it all begins. It becomes easier to make sense of this when you realize that Buddhism, though we think of it today as a religion, was originally just as much an approach to the study of psychology. The central Buddhist psychological text, the Abhidhamma, is a ferociously complex tome of lists and sub-clauses and technical argument. But one of its more straightforward insights is the notion that the mind can be viewed, in many respects, as one of the senses, like seeing, hearing, smell, touch, and taste. Just as we receive smells through the sense door of the nose and tastes through the sense door of the tongue, it's possible to see the mind as a kind of sense door too, or as a screen on which thoughts are projected, like images in a cinema. This isn't how we usually think about thinking. Sounds and smells and tastes, after all, are just sounds and smells and tastes. But thoughts, we tend to assume, are something much more important. Because they come from within us, they feel more essential and expressive of our deepest selves. But is that true, really? When you start meditating, it soon becomes apparent that thoughts and emotions bubble up in much the same uncontrollable, unbidden fashion in which noises reach the ears, smells reach the nose, and so on. I could no more choose for thoughts not to occur than I could choose not to feel chilly when I was woken by the ringing of the morning bell at 5:30 each day, or, for that matter, than I could choose not to hear the bell. Seeing thoughts as similar to the other 5 senses makes non-attachment seem much more approachable as a goal. In the analogy most commonly used by contemporary Buddhists, mental activity begins to seem more like weather, like clouds and sunny spells, rainstorms and blizzards, arising and passing away. The mind, in this analogy, is the sky, and the sky doesn't cling to specific weather conditions, nor try to get rid of the bad ones. The sky just is. In this, the Buddhists go further than the Stoics, who can sometimes seem rather attached to certain mind states, especially that of tranquility. The perfect Stoic adapts his or her thinking so as to remain undisturbed by undesirable circumstances. The perfect Buddhist sees thinking itself as just another set of circumstances, to be non-judgmentally observed. Even more challenging than practicing non-attachment to passing thoughts and feelings is practicing it in the presence of physical pain. To be non-judgmental about being in agony seems preposterous. But it is here that some of the most powerful scientific evidence for cultivating non-attachment has been accumulating in recent years. Some Buddhists, such as Barry McGeard, might object to the implication that the benefits of meditation need to be scientifically proven. But the science is intriguing nonetheless, especially in the case of a series of experiments conducted in 2009 at the University of North Carolina by a young psychologist named Fadel Zeidan. Zeidan wanted to test the effects of meditation on people's ability to endure physical pain, and so, with refreshing straightforwardness, he decided to hurt them. His research employed mild electric shocks, jolts that weren't sufficient to be harmful, but that were powerful enough to make limbs twitch, and participants were asked to rank their subjective experience of the pain. Some then received 3 20-minute lessons in mindfulness meditation over the course of the next few days, showing them how to develop non-judgmental awareness of their thoughts, emotions, and sensations. When further electric shocks were administered, those who used the meditation techniques reported significantly reduced pain. In a related experiment by Zeidan's team, using brain scans and pain created by a hot plate, meditation appeared to lead to less pain for every participant, with the reductions ranging from 11 to 93%. A critic might counter that the meditation was merely providing a distraction, giving the participants something else to focus on, so Zeidan had another group perform a mathematics task while being shocked. Distraction did have some effect, but it was nowhere near as large as that of meditation. And the meditation lessons, unlike distraction, lowered pain levels even when participants didn't actively meditate during the shocks. It was kind of freaky for me, Zaiden said. I was ramping at 400 to 500 milliamps, and their arms would be jolting back and forth because the current was stimulating a motor nerve. Yet, still, their pain assessments remained low. Meditation, Zaiden believes, had taught them that distractions, feelings, and emotions are momentary and don't require a label or judgment, because the moment is already over. With the meditation training, they would acknowledge the pain, they realize what it is, but they let it go. They learn to bring their attention back to the present. If you've ever gripped the arms of a dentist's chair in expectation of imminent agony that never actually arrives, you'll know that a big part of the problem is attachment to thoughts about pain, the fear of its arrival, and the internal struggle to avoid it. In Zaiden's laboratory, focusing non-attachedly on the experience of pain itself rendered the experience much less distressing. As the hours turned into days at the Insight Meditation Society, however, my attachment seemed only to grow more intractable. By the second day, the song lyrics had faded, but in their place came darker irritations. Gradually, I started to become aware of a young man sitting just behind me and to the left. I had noticed him when he first entered the meditation hall and had felt a flash of annoyance at the time. Something about him, especially his beard, had struck me as too calculatedly dishevelled, as if he were trying to make a statement. Now his audible breathing was starting to irritate me too. It seemed studied, unnatural, somehow theatrical. My irritation slowly intensified, a reaction that struck me as entirely reasonable and proportionate at the time. It was all beginning to feel like a personal attack. How much contempt must the bearded meditator have for me, I seethed, silently, deliberately to decide to ruin the serenity of my meditation by behaving so obnoxiously? Experienced retreat-goers, it turns out, have a term for this phenomenon. They call it a vipassana vendetta. In the stillness, tiny irritations become magnified into full-blown hate campaigns. The mind is so conditioned to attaching to storylines that it seizes upon whatever's available. Being on retreat had temporarily separated me from all the real causes of distress in my life, and so apparently I was inventing new ones. As I shuffled to my narrow bed that evening, I was still smarting about the loud-breathing man. I did let go of the vendetta eventually, but only because I'd fallen into an exhausted and dreamless sleep. And in those situations, motivational advice risks making things worse by surreptitiously strengthening your belief that you need to feel motivated before you can act. By encouraging an attachment to a particular emotional state, it actually inserts an additional hurdle between you and your goal. The subtext is that if you can't make yourself feel excited and pleased about getting down to work, then you can't get down to work. Taking a non-attached stance towards procrastination, by contrast, starts from a different question. Who says you need to wait until you feel like doing something in order to start doing it? The problem, from this perspective, isn't that you don't feel motivated. It's that you imagine you need to feel motivated. If you can regard your thoughts and emotions about whatever you're procrastinating on as passing weather, you'll realize that your reluctance about working isn't something that needs to be eradicated or transformed into positivity. You can coexist with it. You can note the procrastinatory feelings and act anyway. It's illuminating to note here how the daily rituals and working routines of prolific authors and artists, people who really do get a lot done, very rarely include techniques for getting motivated or feeling inspired. Quite the opposite. They tend to emphasize the mechanics of the working process, focusing not on generating the right mood, but on accomplishing certain physical actions regardless of mood. Anthony Trollope wrote for 3 hours each morning before leaving to go to his job as an executive at the post office. If he finished a novel within a 3-hour period, he simply moved on to the next. He wrote 47 novels over the course of his life. The routines of almost all famous writers, from Charles Darwin to John Grisham, similarly emphasize specific starting times, or number of hours worked, or words written. Such rituals provide a structure to work in, whether or not the feeling of motivation or inspiration happens to be present. They let people work alongside negative or positive emotions, instead of getting distracted by the effort of cultivating only positive ones. Inspiration is for amateurs, the artist Chuck Close once memorably observed. The rest of us just show up and get to work. No approach to psychology better expresses the pragmatic benefits of non-attachment than Morita therapy, the school founded by the early 20th century Japanese psychologist Shoma Morita. The head of psychiatry at Jikai University School of Medicine in Tokyo, Morita was heavily influenced by Buddhism, and especially its perspective on thoughts and emotions as mental weather, as things that happen to us and with which we can coexist in peace. "People think that they should always like what they do and that their lives should be trouble-free," Morita wrote. "Consequently, their mental energy is wasted by their impossible attempts to avoid feelings of displeasure or boredom." One contemporary practitioner of Morita therapy, James Hill, expresses this distinctive approach as follows. "Many Western therapeutic methods focus on trying to successfully manage or modify our feeling states. The underlying assumption is that if our feelings can be altered or reduced, we will be more able to live meaningful and effective lives, that it is our feelings that hold us back. But is it accurate to assume that we must overcome fear to jump off the high dive at the pool, or increase our confidence before we ask someone out on a date? If it was, most of us would still be waiting to do these things. Our life experience teaches that it is not necessary to change our feelings in order to take action. Once we learn to accept our feelings, we find that we can take action without changing our feeling states. We can feel the fear and do it anyway." By the end of the fourth day at the Insight Meditation Society, things were much improved. The bearded man's breathing had ceased to annoy. All of us seemed to have settled into the timetable that governed our waking, sleeping, meditating, and eating. Where before it had felt rigid and militaristic, now it cradled us through the day. I was actually starting to enjoy meditating, even the walking meditation, which involved moving at a glacial pace across the meditation hall, trying to divide the sensations of each footstep into the component parts of lifting, moving, and placing, and which I'd initially concluded was a waste of time. When, during occasional breaks, I managed to sneak out onto the forest paths behind the meditation center, I found I had become hyper-attuned to my environment. Every crackle of every twig underfoot registered like a splintering diamond. Meanwhile, the vegetarian food we were served in the dining room, nondescript lentil stews, peanut butter on rye crackers, that sort of thing, had started to taste extraordinary. I discovered subtle sub-flavors in peanut butter I'd never have imagined might be hiding there. The Massachusetts winter sunset, viewed from the building's main porch, was often so beautiful as to be almost painful. At night, I was sleeping more deeply than I could remember. And then it all went wrong. Without my noticing the precise moment of transition, the silence of the meditation hall became a combination of courtroom and torture chamber. For hours, I was attacked by barrages of negative thoughts and their associated emotions. Anxious ones, guilty ones, worried ones, hostile, bored, impatient, and even terrified ones. As if they'd all been gathering, just out of sight, for years, waiting for this moment to pounce. Above all, they were self-critical. I was suddenly aware, and somehow all at once, of countless occasions in my life on which I'd behaved badly towards other people. My parents, my sister, friends, girlfriends, or colleagues. Many of these infractions were relatively small in the scheme of things. Harsh words spoken, relationships insufficiently nurtured, but they filled me with sorrow. Months afterwards, I would encounter Buddhist writings suggesting that this was a well-recognized early step on the progress of insight, the stages through which a meditator is traditionally held to pass. It was called knowledge of cause and effect, and had to do with perceiving afresh how one's actions always had consequences. The sorrow that accompanied these realizations, from a Buddhist point of view, is a good thing. It's the fertile soil in which compassion can take root. After about a day of this, though, I began to notice something. The situation in my mind was far from quiet or relaxed. And yet, my constant efforts to return to focusing on my breath, to avoid becoming attached to my thoughts or emotions, seemed to be having an effect. My vantage point on my mental activity had altered subtly, as if I'd climbed two rungs up a stepladder in order to observe it from above. I was less enmeshed in it all. As Shoma Morita might have put it, I was beginning to see it all as mere mental events, to be non-judgmentally noticed. Much of my thinking concerned the past or the future, but I was no longer being yanked off into daydreams or unpleasant memories. I was absolutely present, there on the cushion, watching the performance with something less like panic and more like interest. In some monasteries in the Zen tradition, a monk is charged with creeping up behind his fellow monks and hitting them with a thin wooden stick, or kaisaku, in order to snap them into exactly this kind of utter presence. They didn't hit people with sticks at the Insight Meditation Society, but I felt like someone had. I was watching my own mind with total alertness. The strangest part, though, and the part that is hardest to put into words, was the question of where I was watching all this from. If I'd stepped away from being enmeshed in my thoughts, where was this point of observation? Nowhere? Everywhere? I felt as if I'd stepped into a void. I recalled my conversation with Adina in the taxi, and Pema Chodron's advice about relaxing into the groundlessness of our situation. It was suddenly apparent to me that I spent my regular life in a state of desperate clinging to thinking, to trying to avoid falling into the void that lay behind thoughts. Except, now I was in the void, and it wasn't terrifying at all. By the time the retreat drew to a close, I found to my surprise that I didn't want it to end. I could easily have stayed another week. Moreover, I felt as if I were among friends. Even though I had never exchanged words with most of the other retreatants, and wouldn't have recognized them in the street, given that we'd been keeping our eyes downcast, a tangible sense of community had arisen in the meditation hall. When the gong rang to indicate that we could speak again, small talk felt scratchy and awkward. It seemed to interfere with the companionship. "Well, that was," said Adina, trailing into silence when I encountered her on the porch as we made our preparations to leave. Encapsulating the week in a few words seemed futile. "I know what you mean," I replied. By the time I made it onto the train back to New York, I had a throbbing headache. The normal noises of the non-meditating world were too much for my silence-adapted mind. Discovering the number of emails waiting in my inbox didn't help. But the stressed-out thoughts did slide away more swiftly than before. It seemed I could live with a little bad weather. All this is only one small part of Buddhism's radical perspective on psychology, but the point is central to any negative approach to happiness. It is rarely wise to struggle to change the weather. "Clear mind is like the full moon in the sky," Sung San, a Korean Zen master of the old school who carried a hitting stick, told one audience in America in the 1970s. "Sometimes clouds come and cover it, but the moon is always behind them. Clouds go away, then the moon shines brightly. So don't worry about clear mind. It's always there. When thinking comes, behind it is clear mind. When thinking goes, there is only clear mind. Thinking comes and goes, comes and goes. You must not be attached to the coming and going." And if that wasn't sufficient to jolt his listeners into the realization that they didn't need to be attached to their mental storylines, that they could choose to observe their thoughts and feelings non-judgmentally, and thus find peace behind the pandemonium. "Then," Sung San was fond of saying, "I hit you 30 times with my stick." Chapter 4. Goal Crazy. When trying to control the future doesn't work. Future. Noun. That period of time in which our affairs prosper, our friends are true, and our happiness is assured. Ambrose Bierce, The Devil's Dictionary. In 1996, a 28-year-old from Indiana named Christopher Kays signed up with an adventure travel company to go trekking in the Himalayas. His intention, though it would prove ironic in hindsight, was to take a relaxing break. A punishing career as a stockbroker and then as a corporate consultant had left him burned out. Kays had always been interested in the psychology of the business world, and so he had decided to pursue a doctorate in organizational behavior instead. But first he needed time off, and when he saw an advertisement in a travel magazine for a group hiking expedition to Nepal, it seemed like the perfect answer. As the plane descended into Kathmandu, he recalled later, he was looking forward to a refreshing immersion in Nepalese culture, surrounded by the beauty of the Himalayas. But what Kays encountered in the mountains was a troubling psychological puzzle that was to dominate his life for years to come. While Kays and his fellow hikers were exploring the foothills of Mount Everest, camping at night in tents, a disaster of historical proportions was unfolding near the mountain's peak. 15 climbers died on Everest during that year's climbing season, 8 of them during a single 24-hour period that has since entered into mountaineering lore, thanks largely to the best-selling book Into Thin Air by the climber and journalist John Krakauer, who was among those on the mountain at the time. Kays himself encountered some of the climbers and rescue workers who had been involved. Exhausted men, emerging dazed into the foothills, struggling to make sense of what had happened. Even in the modern era of commercial Everest expeditions, when anyone with sufficient money and some climbing skills can pay to be escorted to the summit, it's still not that unusual for people to die in the attempt. What made the 1996 disaster so chilling, apart from the sheer number of dead, was the fact that it seemed uniquely inexplicable. The weather on the peak was not more perilous than usual. There were no sudden avalanches during the period when most of the climbers perished. The paying customers were all sufficiently skilled for the undertaking. Into Thin Air, controversially, attributed the tragedy in part to the stubbornness and arrogance of Anatoly Bukrev, a Kazakhstani climbing guide. There is some evidence for this, but it's ultimately dissatisfying as an explanation, too. Mountaineers, as a group, tend towards stubbornness and arrogance. Yet disasters on the scale of Everest in 1996 are mercifully rare. In the end, what happened that year looked more like an outbreak of mass irrationality, an episode that reached its apogee around noon on the 10th of May at the Hillary Step, a wall of rock just 720 feet from the summit, in an event that has since become known as the traffic jam. Teams from New Zealand, the United States, and Taiwan, 34 climbers in total, were all attempting the final stage of the ascent that day, from Camp 4 at 26,000 feet to the summit at 29,000 feet. The Americans and New Zealanders had coordinated their efforts so as to ensure a smooth progression up and down the mountain. But the Taiwanese climbers were reneging on an agreement not to climb the same day, and an advance team of guides had failed to secure safety ropes at the Hillary Step according to plan, with the result that the smooth progression soon turned into a bottleneck. Timing is one of the most important variables in any assault on Everest, and so climbers generally observe strict turnaround times. Leaving Camp 4 at midnight, a climber can hope to reach the summit by midday or soon after. But if he or she fails to make it there by the prearranged turnaround time, which might be anywhere from noon until 2 in the afternoon, depending on weather conditions and the team leader's attitude to risk, it becomes essential to call off the attempt and turn back. Failure to do so means the climber risks running out of bottled oxygen and facing Everest's most dangerous weather in the dark. Yet, confronted with the traffic jam at the Hillary Step, the teams pushed on, disregarding their turnaround times. Back at Camp 4, the American mountaineer Ed Viesters watched the climber's slow progress through a telescope and found it hard to believe what he was seeing. "They've already been climbing for hours, and they still aren't on the summit," he remembered thinking to himself, with rising alarm. "Why haven't they turned around?" Members of all three teams continued arriving at the summit for 2 hours after 2 o'clock, the latest safe turnaround time. Doug Hansen, a postal service worker from Washington State who was a paying client of the New Zealand group, was the last to do so at the astonishingly late time of just after 4 o'clock. He had ascended Everest the year before, but had been forced to turn back a few hundred feet from the top. This time, he never made it back down. Like seven others, he was caught in intense blizzards as darkness fell, which made navigation of the mountain impossible, and sent temperatures plunging to minus 40 degrees Fahrenheit. They lay dying, unreached by the frantic rescue attempts that saved several other climbers' lives. Years after climbing Everest had become a feasible project for amateurs as well as professionals, 1996 saw the highest recorded death toll in the mountain's history. And even today, nobody clearly understands why. Except, just possibly, Chris Kayes. A former stockbroker turned expert on organizational behavior might seem to have little to contribute to the post-mortem of a mountaineering disaster. But the more Kayes learned of what had happened, and as he continued to follow the case after returning home, the more it reminded him of a phenomenon he'd witnessed all too frequently among business people. The Everest climbers, Kayes suspected, had been lured into destruction by their passion for goals. His hypothesis was that the more they fixated on the endpoint, a successful summiting of the mountain, the more that goal became not just an external target, but a part of their own identities, of their senses of themselves as accomplished guides or high-achieving amateurs. If his hunch about the climbers was right, it would have become progressively more difficult for them to sacrifice their goal, despite accumulating evidence that it was becoming a suicidal one. Indeed, that accumulating evidence, Kayes was convinced, would have hardened the climbers' determination not to turn back. The climb would have become a struggle not merely to reach the summit, but to preserve their sense of identity. In theology, the term theodicy refers to the effort to maintain belief in a benevolent God despite the prevalence of evil in the world. The phrase is occasionally used to describe the effort to maintain any belief in the face of contradictory evidence. Borrowing that language, Chris Kayes termed the syndrome he'd identified goal-odicy. During his years in the corporate world, Kayes had been troubled to watch goal-setting achieve the status of religious dogma among his colleagues. The situation hasn't changed much today. The hallmark of a visionary leader, it's widely held, is the willingness to set big, audacious goals for his or her organization, and then to focus every resource on achieving them. Individual employees, meanwhile, are encouraged, and sometimes obliged, to define their own personal work objectives, frequently in the form of SMART goals. The acronym stands for Specific, Measurable, Attainable, Realistic, and Time-Bounded. Numerous self-help books advocate ambitious and highly specific goals as the master key to a successful and satisfying life. For example, by this time next year, I'll be married to the woman of my dreams, or sitting on the balcony of my beach house, or earning £10,000 per month. One of the practice's most passionate evangelists, Brian Tracy, in his book Goals: How to Get Everything You Want Faster Than You Ever Thought Possible, insists that living without clear goals is like driving in a thick fog. Clear goals enable you to step on the accelerator of your own life and race ahead rapidly. Yet, Kayes couldn't help but notice that it frequently didn't work out that way. A business goal would be set, announced, and generally greeted with enthusiasm. But then evidence would begin to emerge that it had been an unwise one, and goal-odicy would kick in as a response. The negative evidence would be reinterpreted as a reason to invest more effort and resources in pursuit of the goal. And so things would, not surprisingly, go even more wrong. Kayes believed that a similar thing had happened on Everest in 1996. Chris Kayes is now a professor of management science at George Washington University in Washington, D.C., and as he has travelled the lecture circuit in recent years, using Everest as a metaphor for all that is wrong with our obsession with goals, he has frequently found himself giving offence. A business person should not study topics filled with such great tragedy and emotion, one Russian student lectured him curtly by email. Questions of tragedy and the dilemmas of human existence should be left to the poet, the novelist, and the playwright. These topics have nothing to do with why we study leadership in organizations. But Kayes couldn't let it drop. It would be accurate to say that I think about the Everest disaster probably every day, he told me. Almost like it was a death in my own family. Haunted would definitely be the right word. And there is persuasive evidence for Kayes' hypothesis about what happened on the mountain, hidden away in a largely forgotten psychology study that was conducted in 1963. The study's participants were professional mountaineers undertaking an expedition to Everest. That year, 17 climbers were attempting to become the first Americans to reach the summit, and a psychologist named James Lester realized that the expedition presented an ideal opportunity to investigate what drove people to attempt such ambitious and dangerous feats. With funding provided by the United States Navy, Lester and a handful of colleagues gathered the mountaineers in Berkeley, California, where they administered a series of personality tests. Then, demonstrating an unusual degree of commitment to his research, Lester left sunny California for Mount Everest, accompanying the climbers as far as Camp 2 at 21,000 feet. There, he administered further tests on the climbers and their Sherpa guides. In his book Destructive Goal Pursuit: The Mount Everest Disaster, Chris Kayes relates Lester's basic finding about the typical Everest climber. He was someone who demonstrated considerable restlessness, dislike for routine, desire for autonomy, tendency to be dominant in personal relations, and a lack of interest in social interaction for its own sake. Their felt need for achievement and independence was very high. No surprises there. Lester had confirmed the truism that climbers tend to be domineering loners with little regard for social convention. But more intriguing findings were to emerge from the daily diaries that Lester asked the climbers to keep for the duration of the 3-month period they spent preparing for, then carrying out their trek to the mountain's summit. En route to base camp, the American team had split into two dissenting groups, each with a very different idea of how best to reach the top. The larger group favoured the well-established route via the South Col, a mountain pass ravaged by high winds, leaving it relatively free of snow. But a smaller group wanted to approach via the remote and never previously attempted West Ridge. Even today, in a morbid statistical oddity, the fatality rate for the West Ridge is higher than 100%, meaning that more people have died there than have reached the summit that way. Noting the difference of opinion among the climbers, Lester made sure that their diaries included regular updates on how optimistic or pessimistic they were feeling about their chosen route. Subsequent analysis of the diaries revealed an unexpected pattern. As the day of the summit attempt neared, the West Ridge group's optimism began to fade rapidly, replaced by a gnawing sense of uncertainty. That was only to be expected, given that their route was untried. But as the climbers' uncertainty and pessimism about the West Ridge option increased, the diaries revealed, so did their commitment to it. The more uncertain climbers felt about their possible success in reaching the summit, as Case puts it, the more likely they were to invest in their particular strategy. A bizarre and self-reinforcing loop took hold. Team members would actively seek out negative information about their goal, looking for evidence of weather patterns, for example, that might render the West Ridge approach even more risky than usual, which would increase their feelings of uncertainty. But then, in an effort to extinguish that uncertainty, the climbers would increase their emotional investment in their decision. The goal, it seemed, had become a part of their identity, and so their uncertainty about the goal no longer merely threatened the plan. It threatened them as individuals. They were so eager to eliminate these feelings of uncertainty that they clung ever harder to a clear, firm, and specific plan that provided them with a sense of certainty about the future, even though that plan was looking increasingly reckless. They were firmly in the grip of Goal Odyssey. The happy conclusion of the 1963 expedition, much as it spoils the neatness of Case's argument, is that the West Ridge climbers went ahead with their dangerous plan and survived. Too many of the relevant participants in the 1996 drama perished, meanwhile, for us ever to know with confidence exactly how far the same thought processes were to blame. But Beck Weathers, a paying client that year who was twice left for dead on the mountain, he lost his nose and several fingers to frostbite, having dragged himself back to camp, testified to the plausibility of the notion. "You can over-pursue goals," he reflected afterwards. "You can become obsessed with goals." Mountaineers, of course, don't speak in the corporate language of targets and goal setting. But when they refer to summit fever, that strange, sometimes fatal magnetism that certain peaks seem to exert upon the minds of climbers, they're intuitively identifying something similar, a commitment to a goal that, like sirens luring sailors onto the rocks, destroys those who struggle too hard to achieve it. Ed Viesters, who watched the 1996 tragedy through his telescope, spoke of this lure in vivid terms. "When you're up there, you've spent years of training, months of preparation and weeks of climbing, and you're within view of the summit, and you know, you have, in the back of your mind, you're telling yourself, we should turn around, because we're late, we're going to run out of oxygen. But you see the summit, and it draws you there. And a lot of people, it's so magnetic that they tend to break their rules, and they go to the summit. And on a good day, you can get away with it. And on a bad day, you'll die." If you've ever read a popular book about the importance of planning for the future, you will almost certainly have encountered a reference, and quite possibly several, to the Yale study of goals. This is a now legendary finding about the importance of creating detailed plans for your life. It's cited in the aforementioned Goals by Brian Tracy, but also in scores of other works, from the supposedly scholarly, books with titles such as Psychological Foundations of Success, to the more streetwise, the management manual Train Your People and Whack the Competition. The essentials of the study are as follows. In 1953, students graduating from Yale University were asked by researchers whether or not they had formulated specific, written-down goals for the rest of their lives. Only 3% of them said they had. 2 decades later, the researchers tracked down the class of 53 to see how their lives had turned out. The results were unequivocal. The 3% of graduates with written goals had amassed greater financial wealth than the other 97% combined. It's a jaw-dropping finding and a powerful lesson to any young person thinking of just drifting through life. It isn't surprising, then, that it achieved the status of legend in the world of self-help and in many corners of corporate life. The only problem is that it is indeed a legend. The Yale study of goals never took place. Some years ago, a journalist from the technology magazine Fast Company set out to trace the source of the alleged study. No academic journal reference was ever cited when it was mentioned, so he began by asking the motivational gurus who liked to quote it. Disconcertingly, when asked for their sources, they pointed at each other. Tony Robbins suggested asking Brian Tracy, who in turn suggested Zig Ziglar, a veteran of the motivational speaker circuit and a regular fixture at Get Motivated seminars. Completing the circle, Zig Ziglar recommended asking Tony Robbins. Taking matters into my own hands, I called a senior Yale University archivist, Beverly Waters. She seemed friendly and eager to help, but when I mentioned the goal study, a note of frustration entered her voice. "I did a systematic check years ago when this first arose, and there was nothing," she said. "Then the secretary of the graduating class of 1953 did another systematic check, and nobody he spoke to had ever been asked to fill out such a questionnaire, or anything like that." She added that it was highly unlikely that it had happened in some other year and been wrongly described as taking place in 1953 because the Association of Yale alumni would have been involved, and nobody there could trace anyone who remembered it. Waters sighed. "It's just too good not to be true, I guess," she said. Of course, the non-existence of one study about the benefits of setting goals doesn't disprove the suggestion that setting goals has benefits. There is plenty of very real research testifying to the fact that the practice can be useful. What the story indicates, instead, is how far the fascination with goals has become. You might never have written down any life goals yourself, and you might well disagree with the imaginary Yale study's implication that material wealth is the ticket to happiness, but the basic urge beneath all this is nearly universal. At some point in your life, and perhaps at many points, you likely have decided upon some goal. To find a spouse, to get a specific kind of job, to live in a particular town, and then devised a plan to attain it. Interpreted sufficiently broadly, setting goals and carrying out plans to achieve them is how many of us spend most of our waking hours. Whether or not we use the word goals, we're forever making plans based upon desired outcomes. "Consider any individual at any period of his life," wrote the great French political philosopher Alexis de Tocqueville, "and you will always find him preoccupied with fresh plans to increase his comfort." Tocqueville's use of the word comfort shouldn't distract us here. We are, of course, capable of setting far grander and more selfless goals than that. But the deeper truth remains. Many of us are perpetually preoccupied with plans. It is precisely this preoccupation that the followers of the negative path to happiness call into question, because it turns out that setting and then chasing after goals can often backfire in horrible ways. There's a good case to be made that many of us, and many of the organisations for which we work, would do better to spend less time on goal setting, and more generally, to focus with less intensity on planning for how we would like the future to turn out. At the core of this outlook is the insight that Chris Kayes and James Lester both reached in their studies of Everest mountaineers, that what motivates our investment in goals and planning for the future, much of the time, isn't any sober recognition of the virtues of preparation and looking ahead. Rather, it's something much more emotional, how deeply uncomfortable we are made by feelings of uncertainty. Faced with the anxiety of not knowing what the future holds, we invest ever more fiercely in our preferred vision of that future, not because it will help us achieve it, but because it helps rid us of feelings of uncertainty in the present. "Uncertainty prompts us to idealize the future," Kayes told me. "We tell ourselves that everything will be okay, just as long as I can reach this projection of the future." Obviously, climbing Mount Everest requires plenty of planning and implies a specific goal, reaching the summit. But to Kayes, the evidence suggested that in 1996, an aversion to feelings of uncertainty might have tipped the balance in favor of a fatal overinvestment in goals. "We fear the feeling of uncertainty to an extraordinary degree," the psychologist Dorothy Rowe argues that we fear it more than death itself, "and we will go to extraordinary lengths, even fatal ones, to get rid of it." As we'll see later in this chapter, though, there is a powerful alternative possibility. We could learn to become more comfortable with uncertainty and to exploit the potential hidden within it, both to feel better in the present and to achieve more success in the future. It's alarming to consider how many major life decisions we take primarily in order to minimize present moment emotional discomfort. Try the following potentially mortifying exercise in self-examination. Consider any significant decision you've ever taken that you subsequently came to regret. A relationship you entered despite being dimly aware that it wasn't for you, or a job you accepted even though, looking back, it's clear that it was mismatched to your interests or abilities. If it felt like a difficult decision at the time, then it's likely that prior to taking it, you felt the gut-knotting ache of uncertainty. Afterwards, having made a decision, did those feelings subside? If so, this points to the troubling possibility that your primary motivation in taking the decision wasn't any rational consideration of its rightness for you, but simply the urgent need to get rid of your feelings of uncertainty. Here are the words of one blogger on psychology, David Kane, reflecting on how an intolerance for uncertainty once dominated his own choices. "It's quite disturbing to take a mental inventory of where the intolerance for uncertainty has steered my life," he writes. "It's the reason I spent 3 years and $10,000 learning computer programming when I didn't really want to do it for a living. It's the reason behind every single day I've spent working on careers that don't inspire me. Uncertainty feels like you're sinking, and that it is positively imperative to scramble to the next patch of firm ground, whatever direction it may be in. Once you get there, you can let yourself breathe." Clinging too tightly to goals is one of the principal ways in which we express the obsession with reaching that next patch of ground. To understand one of the many reasons why goals can backfire, consider the experience of trying to hail a taxi in a major city during a rainstorm. If you've ever had to do this, you'll be familiar with the despair it can induce, and you probably think you understand why it's so difficult, since it seems like the kind of economics problem even a 5-year-old could solve. When it rains, more people want cabs, and so demand outstrips supply, making it harder to find an empty vehicle. That's obvious, surely. So when the economist Colin Camara and 3 of his colleagues set out to investigate the problem of the rainy day taxi shortage, taking New York City as their field of study, you can imagine the kind of looks they might have received from their colleagues. Except, as their research revealed, the reason for the problem isn't as obvious as it appears. Demand for taxis does surge when it rains. But something much stranger happens at the same time. The supply of taxis shrinks. This contradicts the standard economic assumption that when people stand to earn more money, they work more. You might have expected cab drivers, who have some discretion over the hours they work, to work the most when demand was highest. Instead, they clocked off earlier when it rained. Further investigation revealed that the culprit was goals. New York taxi drivers rent their vehicles in 12-hour shifts and commonly set themselves the daily goal of taking in double the amount of money that it costs to rent the cab. When it rains, they meet their goal more rapidly and head home sooner. New Yorkers are thus deprived of taxis during exactly the weather conditions in which they need them most, while drivers are deprived of additional income at exactly the time when it would be easiest to earn. The point is not that it's wrong for a taxi driver to choose more leisure time over more income, of course. That's an entirely defensible choice. But that it makes no sense to take that time off when it's raining. Far from behaving like stereotypically rational economic actors, the drivers appear to act more like the pigeons in experiments conducted by the behaviorist psychologist B.F. Skinner. "Having learned to obtain a food pellet by pecking on a mechanism in its cage," Skinner observed, "a pigeon would indulge in a post-pellet pause, relaxing after having attained a predetermined goal." A taxi driver's daily income goal is a very different matter to the goal of climbing Everest, and the researchers didn't investigate the driver's emotional motivations. But it's possible to see the taxi shortage problem as another, more minor example of how uncomfortable we're made by uncertainty. The drivers, it would appear, preferred the regularity and reliability of a predictable daily income to the uncertainty of remaining open to the possibility of earning more. They had invested in their goals beyond the point that doing so served their best interests. New York cab drivers were much on the mind of a university professor named Lisa Ordonez when in 2009 she and 3 of her colleagues embarked upon the heretical project of questioning goal setting. In their academic field, management studies, the wisdom of goal setting was rarely questioned, thanks largely to the work of 2 North American management theorists, Gary Latham and Edwin Locke. Over the course of the previous 4 decades, Latham and Locke had established themselves as the godfathers of goal setting, publishing more than 20 books between them. Their credo was one of the very first things taught to incoming students at business schools. To be a success as an entrepreneur, what you needed first was a business plan focused on specific goals. Anything less was unacceptable. "When people are asked to do their best, they don't," Edwin Locke told one interviewer. "It's too vague." Ordonez and her colleagues mounted the case for the opposition in a 2009 paper with a heavy-handed pun for its title, Goals Gone Wild, in the usually rather dry pages of the journal Academy of Management Perspectives. The goal setting that worked so well in Latham and Locke's studies, they pointed out, had various nasty side effects in their own experiments. For example, clearly defined goals seemed to motivate people to cheat. In one such study, participants were given the task of making words from a set of random letters, as in Scrabble. The experiment gave them opportunities to report their progress anonymously. Those given a target to reach lied far more frequently than did those instructed merely to do your best. More importantly, though, Ordóñez and her fellow heretics argued, goal-setting worked vastly less well outside the psychology lab settings in which such studies took place. In real life, an obsession with goals seemed far more often to land people and organizations in trouble. One illuminating example of the problem concerns the American automobile behemoth, General Motors. The turn of the millennium found GM in a serious predicament, losing customers and profits to more nimble, primarily Japanese, competitors. Following Latherman Locke's philosophy to the letter, executives at GM's headquarters in Detroit came up with a goal, crystallized in a number, 29. 29, the company announced amid much media fanfare, was the percentage of the American car market that it would recapture, reasserting its old dominance. 29 was also the number displayed upon small gold lapel pins, worn by senior figures at GM to demonstrate their commitment to the plan. At corporate gatherings and in internal GM documents, 29 was the target drummed into everyone from salespeople to engineers to public relations officers. Yet the plan not only failed to work, it made things worse. Obsessed with winning back market share, GM spent its dwindling finances on money-off schemes and clever advertising, trying to lure drivers into purchasing its unpopular cars, rather than investing in the more speculative and open-ended, and thus more uncertain, research that might have resulted in more innovative and more popular vehicles. There were certainly many other reasons for GM's ongoing decline. But 29 became a fetish, distorting the organization in damaging ways, fueling short-termism and blinkered vision, all so that the numbers in the business news headlines might match those on the vice president's lapels. But that never happened. GM continued spiraling towards failure and went bankrupt in 2009. It ended up taking a bailout from Washington. At the Detroit Auto Show of 2010, the firm's newly installed president for North America, keen to show how much GM had changed, used the 29 campaign as an example of what it would no longer be doing. "We're not printing lapel pins," he told a radio reporter. "We're not doing any of that stuff." It's safe to say that Edwin Locke and Gary Latham's response to Goals Gone Wild was among the more furious outbursts ever to have been published in Academy of Management Perspectives. Ordóñez and her colleagues were accused of being extremists, of using scare tactics, of abandoning good scholarship by stringing together anecdotes, of spreading falsehoods and insults, and of making unverified assertions. "Oh my God," Ordóñez exclaimed when I asked her about the dispute. "My face was hot for a week. It was just so completely personal." But put yourself in their shoes. They'd spent 40 years doing research into how wonderful goals can be, and here we were coming and pointing out the pitfalls. It was nothing but a temper tantrum. The reason all this academic infighting matters to anyone else is that the two sides represent two fundamentally different ways of thinking about planning for the future. It was unfair, as it happened, for Locke and Latham to imply that Ordóñez and her colleagues had ignored experimental data altogether in favour of anecdotes. But the real lesson of Goals Gone Wild is that the simplified conditions of the laboratory almost never apply in real life. In most artificial studies of goal setting,